My name's Charlotte. If we haven't met before, I'm the site pastor here at CFC East. And if you're new to us, it's a real pleasure to have you in our house. I've said this last few weeks, if I haven't met you before, please come say hi. I meet new people every week and it's such a joy. So please come and introduce yourself. So I am going to kick on in our series in just a moment. But before I do, I want to update you on something in case you weren't at the members meeting on Monday night past. Those of you who were at the members meeting Monday night past will already have heard the news, but maybe you haven't yet. And our wonderful news is we have a new associate East site pastor at CFC East. I mean, feel free to cheer, I know. We need to give him a cheer now, because when you find out who it is, you mightn't, you know. This is how this is going to go. We are honestly so delighted to be adding to our staff team here at CFC East, and Ryan Karyanis will be coming on board as our associate pastor working alongside me in this particular site. Those of you who know Ryan know he's an absolute legend. Like, we love him to pieces. He's been on staff the last couple of years in the role of young adults and Connect pastor, working across all of the sites. But as East has continued to grow and flourish, we have a lot to steward here, and we want to do that really, really well. So we felt it was important to supplement the staff team to make sure that that happens well. So Ryan will be coming on board. He will be helping me with all of the regular pastoral duties. You'll see him preaching, teaching, service leading, doing some pastoral care. But Ryan's main focus will be looking after ministry heads and ministry teams. There is so much goes on across this site day to day. And he'll also be looking at all of our pathways from you enter the door for the very first time till you go home to be with Jesus. We're looking at all of those pathways of discipleship and connection and making sure that we've got everything in place to make sure the people who have been entrusted to us really, really steward, we really, really steward that well, and they flourish in their discipleship to Jesus. So we're honestly so delighted to have him. Now, you guys know this is a big old site. On any given Sunday, we have up to 5 different services happening in this one building, and that's not counting our children's and youth environments. Whenever you add up our services in our auditorium, our cafe church, our sign language service that sometimes happens separately in the afternoons, there's a lot of people here. And so he has a lot of new people to meet. So it's going to take a few months to find his feet, to get to know everybody, to get to know all the different things that happen during the week here. Every single day of the week, something's going on in this building, from support groups for single mums, to breakfast club for a local primary school, to Open Door, which is, you know, a drop-in midweek. There's so many things happening, and it's going to take him a while to get his head around it all. So please give him a few months' grace to settle in, all right, before you... You're going to be bald in about 6 months or grey. I'm pretty convinced that's a wig anyway. Nobody has hair like that whenever you're 55, you know what I mean? So pretty sure it's a wig. Anyway, we're really, honestly, I couldn't be more delighted to have him, his beautiful wife, Lou, you'll get to know her too, their little boy, Judah, joining with us in CFC East. It is honestly such a blessing to have them here, and I couldn't be more delighted. Gibbo will be here next week to pray him in officially with the elders, so we'll do that next week, and then he can't escape. Once he's prayed in, he's stuck. We'll lock the doors and he's stuck. But also, like Ryan, this is a privilege for you too. These people are beyond beautiful, and it will be your great blessing to get to pastor them. So anyway, there we go. Made it a whole 5 minutes into my talk before I got weepy. Cool. Somebody accused me earlier on of breaking Gibbo. They said, Charlotte, you know you broke Gibbo. Gibbo didn't cry, and then you came, and now all he does is yap. You broke Gibbo. I don't think I broke Gibbo. I think he was already broken. Anyway, we're going to crack on today. I want to talk to you. We've been in a series, as we always are, at the start of the year, thinking about our discipleship to Jesus along the lines of some spiritual disciplines and practices we want to build into our life, and some of our core values as well here at CFC. And today we're going to think about the spiritual discipline or the spiritual practice of solitude. And all the introverts said, amen. But don't be getting too cocky, introverts, because I want to make a distinction really, really clear at the start. Isolation and the spiritual practice of solitude are not the same thing. They're not remotely the same thing. So those of you in the room who are a bit like me, who are introverts by nature, who need to get away to recharge your energies, you will know that sometimes you need isolation, as in time away, And really that practice is about, or that action is about withdrawing from. You're withdrawing from the noise, from the demands, from the crowd, from the people, from the stimulation, from it all. You're withdrawing from. Solitude is not withdrawing from. Solitude is withdrawing to. Solitude is withdrawing to Jesus. Solitude is withdrawing into the life of Christ. It's not about withdrawing from. It's withdrawing into him. It's about learning how to let go of everything else and present yourself attentively to Jesus. Like, you and I have all been in conversations where someone's present, but they're not listening. You know, they're not really present. You're not really with me. You're with me, but you're not really with me. And I know that for large sections of my discipleship and my walk with Jesus, I'm with them, but I'm not really with them. You know? And solitude is developing this practice where we're with him. Not where we're just withdrawing from, but we're withdrawing to him. We're on our way to him. And as I began to think about that this week, this idea of withdrawing to, I was actually looking up a passage that somebody had quoted in second service last week. And as I looked at it in the Psalms, I saw the Psalm I've never studied before, never really thought a lot about. And to be honest with you, I'm not going to claim today I really fully understand this psalm after just a week of looking at it, but there was one verse in it that really, really, it just jumped out to me, and it reordered everything that I planned to say this morning. And this psalm is Psalm 45, and it's a psalm, in my Bible, it's called a wedding song. In your Bible, it might be called a love song, but essentially, it's a song about the king's wedding day. So the human king is getting married, and it's a song for the wedding. And the first part of the psalm talks a lot about how great the king is. He's this really, really good king, and not only is he beautiful and powerful, but he's also really just and righteous. And the first part of the psalm kind of paints this picture of the glory of this incredible king. And then the psalm turns and changes direction. And all of a sudden, the words aren't directed so much about or to the king, but to his bride, his incoming queen. And as the song turns to the bride on her wedding, this is what it says. This is what the psalmist says to her in Psalm 45:10. Listen, daughter, and pay careful attention. Forget your people and your father's house. And the whole psalm is this kind of invitation to this woman who's about to become queen, to say, I know that you're leaving some stuff behind in this moment, but forget it all and look at him. Like, look at him. Forget it all. And look, this is the king, and he's here. And you are now getting to be joined to him. Like other people, they get the outer courts. They get to see him from a distance, but you're his bride. Forget it all. Forget your father's house. I know you've loved those things. I know they've been so important to you, but let go and stretch out towards him. And I think, like, there's this beautiful invitation in this psalm to let go and to stretch out. And the whole psalm is about letting go and stretching out because he's worthy. Because he's better than anything you're letting go of. Because this opportunity and this invitation is beyond priceless. And the call to solitude is found in this psalm. Forget. Let go. Let go of everything you have loved, and for just a moment stretch out. Because he's worthy. Because he's worthy. And I have to be honest with you. You see, over these last few weeks, I've found it really, really hard to do that. Not because I'm rebellious, not because I've fallen out of love with Jesus, absolutely not. But my mind has been so distracted by so many things that I have found it incredibly difficult to give him my full attention and affection. And I have felt, even this morning when I was at home getting ready to come, I just felt the beautiful invitation of Jesus. Charlotte, just let go of it all. For just a moment and stretch out. I'm right here. And I'm so worthy of your affection and your attention. And the call to the church is to let go and to stretch out. And
like, those of you who know me well will know, if I could have one thing for this house, like, I want so many things for this house of ours, but if I could have one thing for this house, I would want it to be a house that has let go of everything else in order to stretch out into the presence of Jesus, because we've discovered he's worthy. And we just know it. He's just someone who has deserved our affection and our attention. We've let go and we've stretched out. So there's this invitation to let go and to stretch out. And it made me think about a couple of tables in the Gospel of John. John's a really, you all know John's my favorite, he's my favorite gospel writer. But there's a couple of tables in the Gospel of John, and it's really, really clever the way John sets us up for this idea of the worthiness of him, of letting go because he's worthy. There are a couple of tables in the Gospel of John that fall back to back, and they form this horrific contrast. It's so difficult to read when you read them back to back. The first table is in John 12, and it's coming up to Passover, the last Passover that Jesus will navigate before he goes to the cross. And let me read it for you. This will be such a well-known passage to you. John 12, it says this. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. That's just a side note, whom Jesus happened to have raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him, and then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume, and she poured it on Jesus' feet, and she wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He didn't say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was in it. Leave her alone, Jesus replied. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You'll always have the poor among you, but you'll not always have me. There's this ruckus at the table, and I think it's hard to read in John, but it's really, really hard to read the account of this in Matthew. Because in John, you're kind of like, well, Judas Iscariot, he was a bit of a waste of space anyway. Of course he complained. But actually, that's not the full story. John tells us that part of the story because he's trying to teach us something specific. But when you go to Matthew and you read the same account, this is what it says happens in Matthew 26, verse 8. When the disciples saw this, they were indignant. Why this waste, they ask. Let that hit. Like, just stop for a second and let that hit. The disciples whom he has loved, taught, poured himself out for, been with 24/7. Those disciples look at a perfume that's worth just a year's wages. They look at it being poured out on Jesus and they say, that was a waste. He's not worth that. He's not worth that. What a waste. It's only a year's wages. And these are his disciples. And their automatic response is, what a waste. That's a group of people who have not understood the worthiness of the one who's in the room. They haven't understood the worthiness of the one who's in the room. And Jesus' heart breaks because he knows that in a while, just a matter of days, they'll so wish they had taken everything and poured it out. Because in a moment, they're going to understand how worthy he is in a way that they don't get it right now. What a waste. Imagine. It's only a year's wages, and they're saying, what a waste. And the thing is, then you ask yourself, well, how does Jesus respond? How does Jesus respond? And the beauty of John is he gives us another table to show us how Jesus responds. So this table is the very next table in the Gospel of John, just a couple of days later. And it says this in John 13. It was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that his hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The evening meal was in progress. Devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal. He took off his outer clothing. He wrapped a towel around his waist. And after that, he poured water into a basin and he began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. That's how Jesus responds. That's how Jesus responds. And the interesting thing is, there's a bunch of disciples who don't think he's worthy. And then there's Jesus, who thinks they're very worthy. You're very worthy. You see, there's things going on in this passage that are very easy to miss at first glance if you don't look at it closely. But remember, I'm always saying to you, if there's a detail that feels like, why did we need to know that in the passage, that you should pause and pay attention. And there's a detail like that in this passage. It says this in verse 4. Jesus got up from the meal, he took off his outer clothing, and he wrapped it all around his waist. Now, why do I need to know he took off his outer clothing? Surely that is not the essence of the passage. The main thing is that he knelt and he washed their feet. Why are we putting in that little detail about him taking off his outer clothing? Well, that's because that matters so much. The word for outer clothing there in the Greek comes from the Greek word hamartian. And this idea of the outer clothing throughout the Hebrew and the Old Testament and the Greek then, hamartian, when we get into the New Testament, is building a beautiful theme throughout. And so someone versed in the scriptures understands the significance of this moment in a way that you and I may not, that Jesus takes off his hamartian, his outer clothing. Because you see, your outer clothing, your hamartian, is not just to keep you warm. It's a statement about so many things. I want you to think about coats in the Old Testament. Who does your mind automatically go to when we think of a fancy coat in the Old Testament? Joseph in his Technicolor dream coat, right? And it's not just a coat. What is it? It's a symbol of the Father's favor. That's what the coat is. And you carry that idea right the way through, and you get to the prodigal. When he comes home, the Father gives him his robe, his coat, his hamartian. Because it's a symbol of the Father's favor. So he's got this hamartian on, which is a symbol of the Father's favor, but it's so much more than that. I want you to think about when we track on through scripture and we get to 2 Kings and we meet a guy called Elisha who wants to operate in the power of the prophet Elijah who went before him. And when Elijah's being taken and Elisha's coming behind, what does Elisha want to take hold of? His mantle, his coat, his outer coat, essentially in the Greek, his hamartian. Because whenever Elisha takes Elijah's coat, he doesn't just get his coat, he gets his authority, like his effective power on earth to see the kingdom come. That comes with the coat. So it's a symbol of the Father's favor, but it's also a symbol of incredible authority. And then I want you to track that on through, and I want you to think about the king's robes. I want you to think about when we get into like 1 Samuel. And there's this incredible moment where Jonathan, who is in line for the throne, okay, so he's Saul's son, the kingdom should be coming to him, but Jonathan knows the kingdom is not his. He knows that it's David's. And so what does Jonathan do? He takes off his robe and he puts it on David because it's a symbol of kingly identity. It's kingly identity being placed onto David. That's why David is so upset with himself when he cuts the edge of Saul's robe. Because it's not just a coat. It's so much more. And even though David only cuts off the edge of his robe, he feels this overwhelming guilt because it's his robe. It's not just his coat. It's the Father's favor. It's authority, it's identity. And Jesus walks into a room full of disciples who wouldn't even pour out some perfume before him, and he takes off his coat. He takes off everything that makes him him. The Father's favor, his authority, his identity. He lets it all go and he stretches out to them. Why? Because they matter more to him than all of that. They're worth more to him than all of that. And that moment at that table is an object lesson of the entire incarnation. Where he's like, I will gladly let go of it all the glory, all the authority, all the position, all the adulation, and I will make myself of no reputation because you are worth more to me than all of it. You're worth more to me than all of it. And so the disciples grumble about a year's wages poured out on his feet, but he takes off it all to wash theirs because they're worth it to him. Because they're worth it to him. And I want you to sit for just a minute in the reality of how valuable you are to Jesus. that even today, in this room, he would take the most impure, unworthy part of you, which is symbolized by the feet that have walked through all the dirt and the dust, and so is the most impure part of the person, that he would take the part of you that is most unworthy, that is most impure, that is most covered with the dust and the dirt of your experience, and he would say, that part is more valuable to me than all of my glory. He has let go and stretched out. And in solitude, we have an invitation to reciprocate. For just a moment, to be more like Mary than Judas. And to look in his face and notice what everybody else in the room might be missing. He's worthy. He's worthy of our attention. He's worthy of our affection. He's worthy. And I so desperately want this house to be a house full of people who understand he's worthy. He's worthy. I'm going to invite the team to come, and I'm going to invite the servers to come, and let's just do our absolute best not to get distracted in this moment while we do that. And what's going to happen is this. The team are going to come and they're going to start straight away to give out communion, the bread and the juice. And if you know and love Jesus, I want to invite you to share in this meal. And if you don't, please, like he's waiting here, come to him. Like he's so ready to receive you. But as we drink and eat together today, we are sitting at the table with the one who considered us worthy. That considered us worthy not just of taking off his robe, which happens in John 13. But John 13, Jesus takes off his robe, right? And then he washes the feet, and then he puts the robe back on. And he tracks a little bit more of life. But that begins a descent into nakedness in the Gospel of John. Because there's coming a moment, and just hold the bread in the cup when you get it. There's coming a moment, just a few days on from that, when Jesus will have his outer garments taken and he will not be getting them back. Where violent men will stand at the bottom of his cross and they will barter for his hamartion. Like it's just another coat. Like it's not the robe of the King of Kings. Let's just barter for it like it's another coat. And he will let it go and he will hang completely naked on a cross. And he will give every drop of blood and sweat and every last breath out of his lungs. Until there is nothing left to give, he will pour it all out. And he will do it because he looked at you and said, worth it. Worth it. So if you ask me today why I think I would give my whole life for this man, that's why. The reality is, whenever you give your life completely to Jesus, when you say, I'm not going to hold on to multiple things, he gets my everything, I'm chasing hard after him, there will be people in the room who will look at that sacrifice and they will say, what a waste. I had a teacher one time say to me, Charlotte, you're going to waste your life. Because I had no ambition but Jesus. And maybe they're right. But if I'm going to waste my life, you better bet your bottom dollar I'm going to waste it on him. I'm going to pour it out for him. Because I have met a lot of people in my life, a lot of good people, but I've never met anyone like Jesus. I've never met anyone more worthy of my devotion and my attention and my energy and my time. I have never met anyone more worthy than him. And so there is an invitation to you, wherever you are in your discipleship, to let go, to forget. Forget, don't just let go of it. Because sometimes we let go and then we mourn it. Let go and forget it. Forget it. Let go and forget it. And look in his face, and when you do, you will know you have made the best decision ever. Because he is worthy. And so as we begin to gather on Sundays, I want you to know that Sundays are just as much an invitation to solitude as your time alone with Jesus. Because what happens when you gather in this house is the neighbor can't ring the doorbell anymore. And your phone's off. And the grandkids don't need anything. And your boss can't get a hold of you. And you suddenly don't notice the funny noise the washing machine's making anymore. Because you're here. And you stepped into a place of solitude where you've let go of everything else so that you can fix your eyes on him and remind yourself he's worthy. And so I want you to understand that when we gather on a Sunday, the chief end is not information. The chief end is worship. It's always been about worship. It's always been about drawing aside and forgetting it all and looking in his face and reminding ourselves, oh, you're so worthy, because I do not want to be guilty of the king being in the room and me not understanding how worthy he is. I don't want that to be my story, and I don't want it to be yours. So in these moments, I invite you to take this moment, this sacred, precious moment, to let go, to forget, and to stretch out towards him. Nathan's going to sing a song. I've asked him specifically to sing it. A song I heard him sing in the summer, and I have not been able to stop thinking about it, because if I could write a song that summed up my heart, it would have been this one. My heart for this house, my heart for you. And he's going to sing that over us. And as he does, I'm going to invite you to take the bread and the cup whenever you're ready to do so at some point during that song. But please, for just a moment, let's let go of it all. Let's forget it. And let's look in the face of the one who's worthy.